Hello and welcome to Talking Tudors, a fortnightly podcast about the ever-fascinating Tudor dynasty. My name is Natalie Gruniger and I'll be your host and guide on this journey through 16th century England. Are you ready to step through the veil of time into the dazzling and dangerous world of the Tudor court? Without further ado, it's time to talk Tudors. Welcome back to Talking Tudors, episode 49. I'm your host, Natalie Gruniger. Before we jump into this week's episode, I'd like to thank the wonderful patrons who continue to support this podcast and welcome patrons who joined the Talking Tudors family in September. A huge welcome to C. Sawyer, C. Ferrer, Danica, Sabina, Claire, N. Crawford, Marissa, Lacey, and Shell. I'm so grateful for your immense generosity. A full list of patrons is available on my website under the Patrons tab. If you love Talking Tudors and would like to show your appreciation and support the work I do, just click on the Be My Patron on Podbean badge on the homepage of my website, www.onthetudortrail.com, or click on the Be a Patron button on the Podbean app. Join the Talking Tudors patron family and you'll be automatically entered into our patron-only monthly giveaways. October's prize is a Tudor book bundle, kindly sponsored by the History Press. It contains three fabulous Tudor titles, Catherine Howard by Connor Byrne, Tudor Folktales by Dave Tong, and A History of the Tudors in 100 Objects by John Matusiak. Now, on to today's episode. I'm thrilled that joining me on the show to talk about Catherine Parr and Sudeley Castle is Derek Maddox. Married with two grown-up children and two grandchildren, Derek has lived in Gloucestershire for 39 years. His career started in education, teaching in both northwest London and then Cheltenham for the bulk of his career. Derek initially trained as a physical education and history teacher before gradually moving out of sport and into full-time history. In his latter years at Cheltenham College Prep School, he ran the history department before retirement. Derek then moved across to Sudeley Castle to become the part-time archivist in 2014. My conversation with Derek straight after this short musical break, courtesy of guitarist John Sales.
Thank you.
Welcome to Talking Tutors, Derek. How are you?
I'm fine, thank you. Good to hear from you.
Lovely to have you on the show. Now, it would be wonderful if you could just introduce yourself to our listeners and tell us a little bit about yourself.
Well, my name's Derek Maddock. I come from an education background. I've been teaching since the late 70s, started off with sport and history, and gradually worked more and more towards the history department, working in some private schools in England, in Cheltenham, and ran the department at the end of the time. Retired about 5 years ago and went to Sudley Castle as a volunteer and was asked to be the archivist. And I've had a lovely time since then, sort of part-time archivist, looking after the records, looking after the documents, linking with people like yourself, other researchers. So I'm having quite a nice time at the moment.
Sounds amazing. Now, could you tell us more about your role and what it involves?
Well, we have lots of archives, but most of them are Victorian. Sudley Castle was slighted in the English Civil War, and there were no original records left. The 1840s onwards, they were sort of, the Victorians rebuilt it and started collecting things that were appropriate to the history of the house. So we've got secondary sources in terms of some documents there, plus lots of Victorian sources. I've been tasked with digitalising them, making them available to outsiders, working with researchers. Got a lovely art collection, for instance. I work with quite a few art historians. So that's the sort of basic task that I've been given. I've been there 5 years, and I'm probably about 20% through the amount of documents we've got. So you get the impression of how many we have.
Yes, that sounds amazing. And could you tell us a little bit about the history of the castle, like who built it and when it was actually first built?
Well, Sudley has theoretically about 1,000 years of history. There was certainly a Saxon manor house there, and it was owned by the Empress Goda. She was given it by her brother. She was related to Edward the Confessor and given it by her. It stayed in Saxon hands after the Norman conquest and eventually was taken over by the Boteler family. And that's about the 1400s. And the castle remains that we have today, the oldest part, are due to this Thomas Boteler, who fought for Henry VI in France and was very well rewarded. And three or four of the towers that we have left today are due to him. He wanted to preserve the sort of the family background, so he engaged his son, Thomas, to a woman called Eleanor Talbot, a friend of his from the wars in France, the Duke of Shrewsbury. And unfortunately, Thomas died relatively early, and her sister was married to the Duke of Norfolk, and she went across there, attracted Edward IV's attention. Edward IV had a lovely chat-up line: sleep with me and I'll marry you. Nice man. And she did, but unfortunately for Edward IV, this marriage was witnessed. It's witnessed by a priest who eventually was made the Bishop of Bath and Wells in recognition of his sort of marriage ceremony that he took place. Unfortunately, Eleanor couldn't have children with Edward IV, and after a little while, his roving eye sort of attracted other people, and he married Elizabeth Woodville. Trouble is, he's married to Eleanor Talbot, and we now have this sort of bigamous marriage going on. Therefore, any children from that, the so-called princes in the Tower, Elizabeth Tudor, are illegitimate children, shouldn't therefore inherit. So this was buried, kept hidden away for quite a while. Then we've got Eleanor sort of retiring into a religious community, and she dies quite early. But in her will, she left possessions to Ralph Boteler, her father-in-law. And Edward IV took up exception to this. How dare this woman leave things to somebody else without my permission? And he then organised the sort of the transfer of Sudley into his own possession. So from the sort of 1460s, it becomes a royal possession. We work then through a sort of series of grace and favour appointments, and eventually in the sort of it becomes the hands of Thomas Seymour, your friend Thomas Seymour, that you want to hear about, along with
Yep, my friend Thomas Seymour, exactly. Well, I know a lot of people today go to Sudley, you know, to walk in the footsteps of Catherine Parr. So I did want to talk to you about that, because obviously following Henry VIII's death, King Edward VI granted Sudeley to his uncle Sir Thomas Seymour, which you've just mentioned, who married Henry VIII's sixth wife and widow Catherine Parr. So that I know that the couple moved to Sudeley in 1548, but could you tell us a little bit more about how they spent their time there or what we know about their time?
Well, they married, having Catherine ensured that she wasn't pregnant through Henry, married and spent the first part of their time at Chelsea. Now, Catherine was a lovely woman by all accounts, very skillful, very knowledgeable and so on. Thomas Seymour was, shall we say, a bit of a rogue.
Yes.
He already sort of tried to get influence with the future Elizabeth I. He'd married Catherine Parr, not through love, but through what can I get from this marriage? What power can I get? He wasn't really sort of getting the power that he wanted, and he was sort of caught having, shall we say, tickling fights in the early morning with Elizabeth I. And Elizabeth I was banished by Catherine Parr, and then they moved to Sudeley. In Sudeley, they didn't spend a lot of time at Sudeley, but she was now pregnant with her first child, aged 36, which for that sort of time is quite elderly. So they moved to Sudeley and basically almost tried to set up the equivalent of a Camelot, you know, this wonderful new court, this very Protestant court with lots of religious reformers and so on, all set up at Sudeley. Thomas still had a bit of his roving eye, shall we say, but Catherine and he outwardly seemed quite happy. So they didn't spend a vast length of time there, but you know, the house was dated to the latest specifications, and he brought his architect William Sharrington in to refine some of the buildings. And for, you know, in terms of Catherine, everything was going wonderfully, and she had this baby to look forward to, this little baby Mary. But of course, a girl for Thomas Seymour was not quite what he wanted.
No, that's right, exactly. Now, do we know, you say that they refined the castle and obviously made some embellishments to it at that time. Do we know much about the actual layout and appearance of the castle at around this time?
Effectively, the castle is a double courtyard. The Bottler Towers roughly mark the sort of halfway point, the corners and so on. And going right across the centre of the courtyard was this wonderful banqueting hall, beautiful building. It's one building that was never replaced after the sort of slighting. And so it actually looks a very romantic ruin now. And in that sort of section, wonderful Gothic windows and so on, was Catherine Parr's accommodation and nursery. The nursery was Victorian Gothicized, shall we say. It's a little bit sort of over the top at the moment, but this is what the Victorians believed the accommodation would have looked like. But yeah, you know, private apartments and quite a court being built up, lots of religious reformers, Miles Coverdale, Parkhurst, people like that, all in a position at Sudeley.
Okay, and in terms of Catherine's private apartments or their state apartments, would that have been where the sort of the ruined East Range is at the moment?
Yeah, it's the banqueting hall area, as we call it, yes. So in the areas nearest to the gardens, the so-called Queen's Garden, that is where Catherine Parr's private accommodation was, and there's a pathway that was created for her, covered walkway, where she walked from there to chapel every day.
And now you mentioned that Catherine had baby Mary there, but unfortunately, as many Tudor history lovers know, it didn't end well for Catherine or for baby Mary. So Catherine dies just days after giving birth to her first child, and she's buried there in the chapel of St. Mary at Sudeley with, I believe, Lady Jane Grey officiating as chief mourner. So what else do we know about Catherine's funeral?
Well, there's quite a big account in the Herald's College. There's a book published called A Book of Burials of Truly Noble Persons. And they've actually got quite a bit of detail about the actual funeral itself. As you say, Lady Jane Grey, the lead mourner, Thomas Seymour had by now disappeared off to London. Catherine Parr and the baby can't do anything for him. So, yes, there's suggestions that men didn't always attend the funeral of wives, but we like to think of him more of the rogue and can't be bothered. We've got a sort of full account of the funeral from this book of burials. She was, as it said here, seared and chested in lead accordingly. You know, so to actually be put into a lead casing is quite unusual for that time. And the sear cloth idea is almost effectively a mummification. So she was buried in there, and then a very elaborate tomb was created. We've actually got details of the actual service from this book of burials. Would you like to hear some of those?
Yes, I'd love to. Thank you.
Okay. So the whole area was covered in black cloth, and shields and, as they put here, scutcheons of marriages and so on were decorating the chapel. Black cloth all over the sort of seats and benches. And the only tapers that were there were to actually be placed on the coffin when the actual service commenced. And then there's a list of the proceedings into the chapel. So it says first the conductors in black with black staves, in other words, the vicars, etc. It was led by Miles Coverdale. Mm-hmm. Gentlemen and esquires, knights, officers of household with their white staves, gentlemen ushers, then representative of the Earl of Somerset, Thomas Seymour's brother, in the king's coat. And then the corpse itself borne in by six gentlemen in black gowns with hoods on. Then staff carrying torches and knights to make sure that the corpse was well carried in and the hoods didn't come over their heads. Then Lady Jane Grey and other ladies, mourners, and ladies and gentlemen, and all, then the service actually carries on from there. The actual service was the first royal Protestant service, because every other service had been effectively a Catholic service,
right,
for royalty. So Coverdale's starts his sermon, but just before that, there'd actually been collections of offerings into the alms box, as it's termed. And he then, before he starts his sermon, declares that the offerings which were done not to, for the dead, as in the Catholic rites, but for the honour for the poor only. So that any alms were collected were given out to the poor.
Wow.
And the lights which were carried and stood about the corpse were for the honour of the parson. And then he made a sermon which, according to the writing, was very good and godly. And then the Queen was buried, after which the choir sang the Te Deum in English. So we're talking of a Protestant service, we're talking of it in English, and we're talking of, you know, a whole point being made that it is a Protestant service, not a Catholic service. And then they erected the lovely alabaster monuments and placards. So the Queen, the only royal personage buried in a private house as such.
Yes, it's wonderful, and what fantastic detail in that account. That's so great to have that.
Account in the Herald's College, a book of burials of truly noble persons, well worth a look.
Well worth a look, yeah, I like that. Now, you mentioned Catherine's alabaster tomb, so I want to hear more about this. I've been to Sudley several times and seen it. It's beautiful, but I believe it was built a little bit later, is that right?
The alabaster tomb that's there at the moment is a Victorian Gothic. The church, well, basically, Sudley chose the wrong side in the English Civil War, in that it's a very strong parliamentary county and they went for the royalist side. So two sieges later, the castle was ordered to be slighted. And that included the church where Catherine Parr's body was buried. And effectively, there was nothing there for 180 odd years. So there was a rabbit farm, trees were growing up, soil about 6 foot high. So nothing actually was known. Well, you know, the body was known to be there, but where was it or anything like that? No, not a clue. So the 1780s, permission was given for some ladies to hire a digger, and eventually they found the body. They eventually dug down and found a section of alabaster tomb, a plaque saying, "Here lieth the Queen." So effectively, they did discover the body, which then was, shall we say, hunted for souvenirs.
Yes.
Bits of hair, teeth, things like that. And eventually the body was being inspected, shall we say, in the politest term, too often. So they then buried the body, took the body away so it couldn't be raided any more times. The Victorians were not going to rebuild the castle. Yeah, Victorian Chatelaine, Emma Dent, wanted it left as a romantic ruin. She got people like John Ruskin on her side. But eventually she was persuaded otherwise, and her husband organised the building. The basic walls were still the same. No roof, no windows, nothing else. So by the 1863 service, they'd actually rebuilt the entire chapel. And in that was a wonderful new Victorian tomb to Catherine Parr. They looked for the best possible architects, the best possible woodworkers. People who eventually worked on the Albert Memorial, for instance, were hired to do the work. And the biggest problem they found was getting a big enough piece of alabaster. But after about 2 years, they managed to get some from Ely Cathedral, and they've carved this wonderful effigy of Catherine Parr. I don't usually like Victorian Gothic, but this is a beautiful little beautiful tomb, and you can get around the back side of it as well. So you've got the body of Catherine lying there, hands clasped in prayer, very, very attractive tomb.
It is. It's absolutely stunning. With the light coming in, it's just very atmospheric, isn't it? Now, just going back when she was originally buried, obviously the castle was slighted, you mentioned that. So is there any account of what marked her original burial place in Tudor times? Was there some sort of monument, or do we have no information about that?
There was an alabaster monument erected Tudor times. And there was a Latin epitaph written by Dr. Parkhurst, which was placed over that completely disappeared. Presumably that was wrecked by the parliamentary soldiers. There was just no indication at all of where the body was, other than the logical assumption that it's going to be either side of where the altar would have been on the east end. So that's where eventually these two ladies organised their dig, and in 1782 they found the body.
Now, Derek, let's fast forward a little bit to 1592, when Elizabeth I visits Sudley Castle during her summer progress to celebrate the anniversary of the defeat of the Spanish Armada. Now, I've heard quite a bit about this three-day party. Can you tell us a little bit about what went on?
Yes, I gather you've talked to Mayor out of Dig Benches. Well, we know that Elizabeth had been there twice before, but only in sort of passing. The reason she came, commemorate the Armada. Also, Giles Chandos had kept a local standing army to protect the country during that time, so it was in recognition of that. I suppose you could also say it's the summer she's keeping out of London and possibly the sweating sicknesses and so on. And also, to a degree, she had the idea of making it her business to depress the nobility. So she expected everything possible to be done for her. So we have this three-day party. Giles Chandos built a banqueting hall, which Dig Ventures discovered last year, built a sort of stage area with water features, which we also discovered, or rather Dig Ventures discovered last year. So we've got this sort of huge area of created for the celebration for this three-day party. Basically, Giles Chandos spent very heavily, with the hope he's going to get something out of it. And basically all he got really was bankruptcy. But we've actually got, there was something published in, there's a modern book, The Progresses and Public Processions of Queen Elizabeth I, Volume 3, 1579 to 1595. And in that is an account of the Sudley entertainment. And we have a book from 1815, which, okay, it's a secondary source, but again, if you look at the modern interpretations and this, it's basically the same elements. And it's 3 days' worth of plays, parties, all in this banqueting house, these wonderful gardens, this theatre space, and so on. All the speeches sort of accidentally praise the wonders of Elizabeth I and the Virgin Queen and compare her with everybody else and say there isn't any comparison. This is the best queen ever and the most beautiful, the most attractive, etc. So there's speeches connected with the Cotswolds, and there's a king of the Cotswolds all praising the queen. And basically, it all works up towards giving her presents. So she got a dart of gold set with diamonds, a key of gold set with diamonds, sword of gold set with diamonds. Guess what? Truncheon set with diamonds. A daisy in gold set with diamonds. And all these sort of speeches and so on going on for 3 days. Unfortunately, it rained very heavily. So the third day was a little bit of a washout. But all this sort of elaborate sort of presentations and so on didn't quite work out as well as Giles Chandos hoped. He basically went bankrupt. And very quickly after this, the castle went into the hands of his brother. So he couldn't afford it any longer.
Oh, dear. So Elizabeth got lots out of it, but it doesn't sound like he got any.
Her idea was almost to depress the nobility. If you keep them poor, there's no way they can rise up against you.
Oh, yeah, that's true. So in terms of the layout of the castle and the grounds now, where would that kind of have taken place?
Well, we have what we call the Queen's Garden at Sudley, and that was, I would think, probably about 40 metres by 40 metres, and we thought that was quite substantial, and a balustrade at the back with a raised area which we had thought Elizabeth I walked on. But we knew there was a field beyond that with lots of lumps and bumps. Now, I mentioned Emma Dent, the Victorian chatelaine. She was convinced this was the Saxon manor house and organised a search in 1875. She hired an archaeologist called Canon License. He didn't find any Saxon remains, so she suppressed the report. Then there were still these lumps and bumps, and they seemed so rectangular and linear, not natural. So the English Heritage took a series of aerial photos and suggested we investigate further. we got Exeter University in, and they did a big sort of LIDAR, geophys, etc. survey. And again, lots of rectangular links and things like that, things that are not in nature. And 2 years ago, we brought in the group Dig Ventures that Maya's part of. And they did some test pits and found enough evidence to go further. Last year, they came back and they focused on two specific areas, a banqueting house. And we're talking of quite a substantial building here. They discovered properly dressed stone, roof tiles, a small bit of leaded glass, a small bit of painted plaster. And I happened to be there at the same time they dug out a big rim of a cooking pot and some butchered bones. So it wasn't just a sort of lean-to barbecue area. It was a proper barbecue on the brain now, a proper sort of dining area. And when you actually stand there, you realise how high you are above the rest of it. And then there's some lovely gardens, and then that works between the two to, again, it looked like a semicircular area. And they started digging in this area. And as they dug down, they discovered heavily compacted clay. And we knew that there was a natural spring going under there because the fountain in our current Queen's Garden is gravity fed. And we discovered that there was actually this heavily compacted clay. Think of the butyl liner of a water feature. That going around a circular area, which we've interpreted as the play. We know that there were plays performed. Giles Chandos brought in a theatre group to perform for the Queen. So this turned out to be the theatre area. So it's now sort of three times bigger than we thought it was. And we've got Dig Ventures coming back next year to do further excavations. And it's just fascinating sort of seeing history evolve under your eyes. I was sort of interpreting for various visitors at the time. And each day something new was discovered. It was fascinating.
Yeah, it's amazing. I can't wait to hear what else they find next year. Yeah. Very exciting. Now, Sudeley is already home to some wonderful Tudor artefacts, including Catherine's prayer book. What other treasures can Tudor history lovers see at the castle?
Well, we've got three Catherine's books.
Right.
One you refer to is the Sermon of St. Chrysostomi. I can never pronounce that word. Which has got actually Catherine's signatures and also some writing in her own hand in it. We have a book of prayers and meditations, with a wonderful sort of cover sort of made by the nuns of Little Gedding. And we have her actual writing, The Lamentations of a Sinner. So we've got three books. We've also got two original letters from her to Seymour. One of them referring to the baby, the little nave in her belly that she felt the baby move. There's another one referring to Edward Seymour and taking the Queen's jewels and not giving them back and how she could have bitten him. We got one of the other sort of copies from Hatfield of other sort of letters that were there. Technically not Tudor, but we've got a wonderful series of The Tudor Court by George Virtue. Now, he was an engraver in the late 17s, and he was given access to the Holbeins of the Royal Collection in Windsor and made a copy of each of them with the intention of printing them, but never printed them, never made them into a sort of series of prints. So we have this wonderful copy of the entire Tudor Court, well, not the entire, but sort of 33 pictures of the Tudor Court, which are just stunning to look at. They just look so lifelike. They really bring history alive. We've got a wonderful painting of the Tudor succession. There was a series of allegorical paintings made, and this is the last one. And we've got Henry in the centre giving the sword of state to little Edward. And on Edward's side is Elizabeth with the goddesses of hope and plenty behind. And on the other side, just off the carpet representing the Church of England, is Mary and Philip of Spain with a god of war behind it. So a subtle little message being given there. And we've got a lovely, again, not technically Tudor, but a later piece of glasswork, Elizabeth in her dress that she celebrated the Armada in. Beautiful when the light is coming through that side. Quite an unusual painting as well. We've got Henry's younger sister, Mary, who was married off to Louis XII that short while and then came back and married Charles Brandon, Duke of Suffolk. So a portrait of her, which I find I've never seen one elsewhere like that. So we've got a lot of paintings and so on of the time, things bought in the Strawberry Hill sale that claimed to be Elizabeth I. You know, though having said that, Elizabeth I controlled her image very carefully. So you look at these and think, these aren't Elizabeth I, but they're certainly of that time. So some glorious things there. Working with these every day is rather special.
It's very special. You're extremely lucky. Now, tell me about, I have seen, if I remember correctly, a lock of strawberry blonde hair. Tell me about that.
Well, that's one of five that we have at Sudley. As I mentioned earlier, there was these ladies organised this dig, and word got out, and various other people went. Having cut the cere cloth in various parts, of course, the body starts to decay. So people took this hair for preservation. The teeth started to fall out, so somebody took the teeth. Now, one of these people that did this then committed suicide. So then the word very quickly spread by these sort of owners of Sudley at that sort of time that there's a curse on that. Anybody that touches this body will die. So lots of the grandchildren gave back pieces of hair and the tooth and so on. So we now have five pieces of hair and her tooth back at Sudley through the the kindness of the grandchildren, because they didn't want the curse to carry on with those. But yes, we still have some of those. And her hair does appear to be very light in colour.
So over the years, you mentioned the curse. I hadn't heard that curse story, by the way. That's interesting. Over the years, many people have actually reported unusual sightings and occurrences at Sudley Castle. Some have even reported seeing perhaps the ghost of Catherine Parr or another Tudor woman. Have you ever had anything strange happen to you at the castle?
Sorry, I'm a bit too much of a cynic.
So that's a no, I guess.
That's a no, I guess, yeah. We've got two Victorian accounts. Emma Dent's sister, Marianne Brocklehurst, was quite a skilled artist. Right. And Emma Dent's maid, Bayliss, apparently at one stage ran screaming out of a room and because there's a ghost there and so on. And Marianne Brocklehurst had a lovely cartoon of that, which at the moment we've got on display. There's also an account by the bailiff, a man called Frederick Simmons, who was working in what is we now call the Chandos bedroom. Then it was called the Tapestry Room. And he felt a presence and somebody else in the room, so he got out very quickly. So there are documented accounts. But for me, no, I'm too much of a cynic, sorry.
That's absolutely fine. It is a very atmospheric place, I think, though. And I think it does have this real sense of like timelessness when you're there. It's absolutely beautiful. All right, wonderful. Now, Derek, we're up to the part of the show where we play a little game of 10 to go. So this is just 10 sort of fun questions to get to know you a little bit better. So are you ready for that?
Okay. Yeah, sounds worrying, but
no, nothing. Nothing scary, don't worry. So number one, what's something you love about where you live?
Accessibility to the countryside. I'm the bottom slopes. I live in Cheltenham, but I'm the bottom slopes of Leckhampton Hill. So within a minute by car or 6 minutes or so by foot, you can be on the hill and looking over the glorious Cotswolds.
What's a book that's on your to-be-read list at the moment?
I've got a book at the moment that's a friend of mine who I used to teach with. He was also a history teacher and sports teacher. Good friend, godfather to my children. He died, unfortunately, of cancer. He wrote a book about British education. So, it's one of these books that you want to read, but, you're also missing this man so much. He was just a sort of lovely Renaissance man.
Right, I see. They're very sentimental connection there.
Yeah, it is. It's not a book that everybody would want to read, but for me it does mean something.
For you it is, yeah. So yeah. What do you like to do in your spare time?
Well, since I retired, I always liked doing something physical. I now have an allotment, so I garden quite a bit. I'm self-sufficient in fruit and lots of vegetables, and I like cooking as well.
That's fantastic. I love. I've seen some allotment videos on YouTube and things, and it looks like a lot of fun. I like it.
Yeah, so growing food, cooking food and drinking wine. Those are, how about that for an activity?
That sounds like fun, actually. I like that. Do you have a favourite season?
I do love spring, when you get that wonderful bright green colour of the leaves bursting out again. That's for me, I think.
Yeah, me too. We're currently enjoying the start of spring here in Sydney, so it's lovely. What was your first paid job?
I did a series of sort of jobs in between sort of it's at school level. Do you count those?
Yes, yeah, why not?
Right. I went bean pulling. I lived in Fend, which is very much agricultural country in England, and you used to do sort of go and pick, gangs would go and pick beans or vegetables or whatever. So that was my exciting job. 1/6 for a bag. So it shows how long ago it was.
Lovely. Name a new skill that you'd like to learn.
I would love to be able to draw or paint.
Yes.
I love art. I love art history, but yeah, my attempts to draw something are non-existent.
What's an ideal Sunday for you? How would you spend an ideal Sunday?
Probably in the hills, having a walk, coming back and cooking. And we only tend to drink wine at the weekend, so then a nice glass of wine.
Yeah, that sounds good. Now, apart from Sudley Castle, of course, what's another historic house that you enjoy visiting?
One of my favourites, which I think most people would have heard a lot of, is Hampton Court.
Oh, yes.
It was sort of in the 70s, nothing special to visit at all, but the education department there have worked very hard. There's a brilliant exhibition of young Henry, which really explains the background. You know, you're close to paintings of the cloth of gold, for instance. And I used to take school groups around there and always set the alarms off because I tend to be quite effusive in my hand movements and go across the lines. And, you know, then there's Court, you know, the Tudor Hall, and, you know, you're right in front of key paintings in history. I just love to Hampton Court. Wonderful place.
I completely agree with you. It's one of my favourites. Now, the very last thing, very, very last thing we do, I always ask my guests for a Tudor takeaway. So this is something for our listeners to explore after the episode. Might be a website, a movie to watch, a book to read. Do you have a Tudor takeaway for us?
Can I give you a couple?
Yes, please.
bbc.co.uk/history. I used to use it a lot when I was teaching, and they keep that updated with any sort of references. You know, sort of people have done programs and things like that. And also for younger kids, there used to be a whole series of games on there, you know, but they would be educational games. So, for instance, Mary Queen of Scots, the Babington plot, you could decode the letters, things like that. So There's very good things on the BBC website. Sometimes you have to hunt them out a bit, and it varies as according to what's there, but that's very good. So that's one thing. My second thing is the Shard Lake series by C.J. Sanson. Now, he is an academic historian, but he's turned into a novelist. And Shard Lake is a, as they call it, a crookback lawyer, and sort of hunchback lawyer. Works for Cromwell, and he seems to feature in all the key elements of Henry VIII's time, Edward VI's time, and he's written 7 books, things like Dissolution, Dark Fire, Sovereign, and so on. And one of them was called Lamentations, which focused on Catherine Parr's book that we have at Sudley. I'm trying to get him to come to Sudley and do a talk at some point. So this author, C.J. Sanson, academic historian, but these sort of history detective stories. So you really feel part of, you know, his descriptive powers are brilliant, and it's academically accurate as well.
Fantastic. Yes, they're very popular, those books, aren't they? I've heard lots about
them. Everybody I've introduced them to loves them.
Loves them, yeah. Okay, yeah. Great. Well, they're two fantastic takeaways for our listeners to explore after this. And I'll add links to the BBC website that you mentioned to make it nice and easy for everyone to find it. But Derek, thank you so much for talking Tudors with me.
You're welcome. Yeah, I do tend to go on a bit. So sorry, it was a bit rambling at times, but
not
I do enjoy
problem.
Working at Sudley. So anybody comes to England, come and visit.
Well, that brings us to the end of this episode of Talking Tudors. Thank you so much for listening. If you have any comments or suggestions or just want to say hi, please get in touch with me via my website, www.onthetudortrail.com, where you will also find show notes for today's episode. If you've enjoyed the show, please share the podcast with friends and family and click on the all-important follow button so you'll never miss an episode. I also invite you to join our Talking Tudors podcast group on Facebook, where you can interact with other Tudor history lovers and hear all the behind-the-scenes news. It's time now for us to re-enter the modern world. As always, I look forward to talking Tudors with you again very soon.